Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for architecture firms. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius. This is Michelle.
Hey, everyone.
This is Jason.
What's up, guys?
And you are listening to Spaces Podcast. Thank you for coming back. Season 3 is officially underway.
Feels like it's been a long time.
It has. It has been a very long time. So today we're going to get started talking about construction and the evolution of construction. Jason, you probably are most familiar with kind of what's going on in the field. How have you been dealing with the evolution of construction? Anything of late that kind of has popped up?
Yeah, actually, we're expanding some of our operations. Our cabinet company is now actually shipping to Northern California and doing installs in Northern California, which is new in the last 6 months. And one of the builders that we started working with is actually doing full panelized construction. So shipping full panels, doing all that kind of stuff. And it's actually super cool. It was the first time I can tell you that when I walked to go do a field measure and verify things for, you know, cabinets and stuff, literally everything was exactly as the blueprint said.
Yeah.
The only thing that changed is a little bit of variability when you go into, like, you know, simple small walls that are being added that are not part of the structure, if you will. Those were a little bit out, which is interesting, which is an interesting example of, okay, you've got machine built and then you've got, you know, humans doing measuring and stuff like that. But it was really cool to see. And the funny part was the frame walk date on that community got moved up by 2 weeks because they were ahead of schedule. Because it's actually the first time they were, it's a big national builder too. It was the first time they were doing the panelized construction.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, it went up way faster than we thought. Wow. So it's really neat.
What kind of product
neat.
Was that?
What's that?
What kind of product?
Big single family. It's going to sell for roughly detached? $2 million in San Bruno.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Detached.
Interesting.
So it's really neat to see, because I was like, I remember getting the call and they're like, hey, we're going to meet this Wednesday. And it's like Monday. Can you come up? I'm like, oh crap. Right. I'm like, what? They're like, we're 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Oh, I'm like, God. Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. So it was really very neat to go see it. And as we were walking the product and going through the framework, we're seeing things where the human error part started messing up stuff. Not bad, but there was things like, this shouldn't be that way, this shouldn't be that way, because it wasn't critically drilled or whatever from the factory. So people started having to put their own holes in certain things that you would think would be fine to do on site, but you literally start seeing the dichotomy of the two.
Yeah.
So it was super cool, and I'm really interested to get going through it, and I'm really interested to see how static those measurements stay as we go through the project space.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. And then there's another project that we're on right now, which I think grand opens this weekend, and I would suggest anybody go check it out. Trumark Homes is building it in Brea. It's got variability in, it's a townhome construction, variability in floor style built in. So like the main floor, the kitchen can be in three different places. The secondary floor has four different variations. The third floor has four different variations, and the bottom floor I think only has two. But you can literally put the kitchen at the front, the middle, or the back, and then that could determine if it's a bedroom, a great room, whatever. And it's literally built that way, so you can select it even after the building's already put together. It's really kind of a neat concept.
Somebody else had that system that they tried to create, and they like trademarked the system name. I can't remember who it was.
I'm not familiar. Out here?
Yeah.
I mean,
I'll mention it.
Well, so is that, that's modular as well, the Trumark project in Brea?
Yeah. So again, they're working with the same company that the other one's working with in San Bruno.
What is the company?
The other one's D.R. Horton. Integra.
Yeah, we've talked about them before.
We have. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is everyone's been talking about the modular building for what, 3 years now?
Yeah.
And you know, I think a lot of the home builders have been reticent and reluctant and just not really sure how it fits within the business model of production home building.
It's getting forced down their throat.
Well, yeah, I don't think they have a choice. And they're basically getting to the point where they're going to have to start looking. What I'm really excited to do, I was in a, I don't know if you were there, but that we had a next gen event meeting, coffee talk or something with Tim Myers from, or not, no, no, Tim something from Myers.
Tim Research, Sullivan.
That guy. And yes, that guy.
That guy.
And we were talking
super
a lot.
Super smart guy.
Super smart guy. Great deal. And he was talking about leader to leader that they were doing at PCBC maybe or something like that. And talking about how they get together with all these, you know, CEOs and whatnot and talking about the change coming and whatever. And so when he asked us, I said, do you think they're really willing to implement change when they're 62, 63, 65 years old? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they're waiting for the last run up and they're going to say, I'm out. Do they really want to do that? And he kind of was like, okay, off mic. No, I don't think they're going to be the ones to do that, because why change it now? So I think what's going to happen is if we get a little bit of that changing in the guard, I think you have people that are a little bit more willing to step out and say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. The gal in purchasing for D.R. Horton that's up doing this one in San Bruno, mm-hmm. she's younger and was like, this is what we're going to try. And so now all of a sudden it's got notoriety, like literally their corporate office calling saying, what are you guys doing? You're 2 weeks ahead of schedule.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. So I think it takes, you know, our generation, this age gap, to go ahead and press in there and start forcing some of that change.
Yeah, definitely. Michelle, did you have some input as far as what you're seeing on the development side?
Not anything that's earth-shatteringly different than what we've kind of talked about over the last year, some of the themes of labor shortages and poaching of labor to other jobs.
Yeah.
We're still seeing quite a bit of that in Northern California, so maybe D.R. Horton is onto something you know, with their project.
Yeah.
I think there's still a fair amount. In fact, I would argue that the majority of builders are still not grabbing on quite yet to the modular. And I'm not saying they won't, mm-hmm. but I think, you know, there's a tendency to do what's always worked. And
it's safe.
It's safe. But it's predictable.
Yep.
And I think there's an argument of, you know, not necessarily quality, but just optionality that you get when you're not doing modular, not doing production.
Easier mm-hmm. to handle variability is what
you're
saying.
Correct. Okay. Yeah.
So this next year or two are going to be very critical, because they're either going to have to jump on board very quickly or just get bulldozed if it works out, because there's a lot of companies starting to pop up. But if it actually clicks over and they start to see huge returns and way shorter construction times, if you're not at least looking into it, you're going to be way behind the eight ball.
Well, I think who's going to grab onto it even faster than the home builders will be the apartment builders. The product that they're building is a little more boxy. Repetitive and mm-hmm. boxy. And so you can quite literally stack unit after unit after unit after unit. You're not having to create variables in order to justify premiums or things of that nature that you would in a single family environment.
Well, yeah. I think the most important part is, one way or another, regardless if it takes the panelized construction or not, at least people are starting to change.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest thing, is like, okay, let's open the door and let's see what else is available, and hell, let's give it a shot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, where I would say 3, 4, 5 years ago, like, that's not even an option, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, we're not doing that. We don't do that. Even though you're like, you're doing it with trusses. You know what I mean? Like, what's the difference? But it's nice that you're finally starting to see, and I really believe it's the infusion of some of our thought is the next generation that's coming through and saying, yo, this could work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, give me a shot. And then all of a sudden you see people going, hey, this works. What are you doing?
Yeah.
The same thing I've been telling you about for 3 or 4 years. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing. And I think that's what it's going to take, because if you look at innovation is not usually bred out of the same people doing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's somebody coming in and challenging that market. You know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden everybody grabs onto that, because this is the new frontier. It's shiny. It's cool. It's new. Everybody wants it. And then everybody's like, okay, yeah, we all better do that too. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
So we're going to get into a deeper conversation on that later. We actually have a guest coming on later on in the season. We're going to get into the modular and some of the off-grid and all that stuff. So we'll dig into that deeper later
on. You say off-grid like the show's off-grid?
Off-grid homes.
Right on.
But today we're going to talk a little more generally about construction. We'll probably touch back on this again a little bit more. But today we brought in a guest, and our guest has spent her career in building science forensics. discovering why buildings fail and working with owners, builders, and architects to remedy the problems that occur. Her new construction consulting business helps architects use building science not only to mitigate risk of failure, but also to help them make their projects as energy efficient as they are beautiful. She is the founder of the Instagram account at Building Science Fight Club, an educational project.
Yeah, look that up.
An educational project that teaches architects about building science and construction. She graduated from Princeton University and studied at Boston Architectural College before completing her Master of Architecture degree at New School of Architecture and Design. Please welcome Christine Williamson. Christine, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. Also, is this, I heard you saying it earlier, is this the kickoff to season 3?
Yes, season 3.
You chose me?
Lead off hitter. Lead off hitter.
Yeah, so you're getting us kicked off. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's fun. You guys talk about really neat stuff. I really was enjoying the discussion earlier on modular construction. And what I loved about just the setup of your entire conversation is that you weren't presuming, like a lot of people do when they approach that particular topic, that it's completely black or white. Right. In that either everything is modular or nothing is modular. And what's kind of neat is seeing innovation in this part of our business, of our industry, where there are different solutions to meet very specific needs. Michelle talking about apartment buildings. Yeah. And hotels, for example, have really different needs than high-end custom home building solutions and production homes, totally different.
Yeah. So Christine, aside from your bio, is there anything that you missed out on or any additional insight you want to give us, hobbies you have or anything like that?
I mean, is there anything that's not covered in that? Yeah, there's lots that's not in that. But no, that's a pretty accurate description of what I do. I figure out why stuff isn't working the way we want it to work. I help people handle risk in construction at the outset and figure out, okay, how do we avoid these types of problems? And there are a lot of different ways you can install a window, for example. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, there's a point of diminishing return for people if you install 20,000 windows a year, are you going to alter the installation of, 19,999 to improve the one that leaks, or is it cheaper just to fix the ones that leak? So how do you kind of find your sweet spot for risk? So that's on the new construction. And then the third thing I do is teach. Teach people how to figure this stuff out, help them make better decisions about their own projects. Because everybody's got different risk tolerance and different performance goals. And sometimes we struggle with that too. We think of building as, well, there's only one right way to do something. And I want to do things the right way. I don't want to do things the wrong way. Well, it's kind of an overly simplistic way of viewing actually lots of industries, but in particular ours, where there's so many different ways of doing things. It depends on what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. We can start with that part of you teaching. But before we do, I want to give a little bit of a background on how construction has evolved thus far. And to do that, you got to go back in time. Excavations at a number of sites in Europe show circular rings of stones that are believed to have formed parts of shelters from some time before 12,000 BCE. Construction is a process as old as humans. As a function to mitigate the effects of our climate, early primitive humans used natural resources that were available around them to build mud huts and stone monoliths for shelter. Early tools of the trade were animal bones, copper plates, and axes. Following the agricultural revolution in 10,000 BCE, nomadic lifestyles came to an end as permanent structures were constructed. Historians believe that what we now know as traditional construction began to take shape in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia.
The Egyptian pyramids are some of the first examples of large-scale permanent structures. Evidence of composite construction, known as wattle and daub, displayed the use of woven lattice wood strips, wattle, and a sticky material, daub, which was made of wet soil, clay, sand, animal dung, and straw. Heavy timber buildings began to appear in the Neolithic period, but were restricted in member size due to limited capabilities of stone tools. As populations grew and tools advanced, construction became a cornerstone of civilization. The advancement in tools and methods brought about achievements around the world. Etruscans, who lived in the northern part of Italy, influenced Roman construction with their stone construction based on the arch. Romans went on to develop spectacular arch bridges, aqueducts, temples, and other public buildings utilizing this method, and later advanced into early concrete, timber, metal construction, brickmaking, and brick masonry construction. In China, there were remarkable achievements in masonry, logistics, and land surveying methods, which were exemplified in the construction of the Great Wall. By the 18th century, behind the first industrial revolution, the introduction of cast iron and clay tile stoves brought about an efficiency in plumbing and interior heating in Western Europe. And the puddling process for making wrought iron and rolling mills powered by steam engines produced wrought iron bars, angles, and other shapes. These advancements led to a series of dramatic iron and glass buildings for conservatories and exhibition halls like the Crystal Palace, built in London's Hyde Park to house the Great Exhibition of 1851. A significant achievement of the period was the emergence of building science, a collection of scientific knowledge that focused on the analysis of the physical phenomenon affecting buildings. Mathematical models were used to predict structural performance, such as the elastic theory, first presented by Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler in his theory of column buckling in 1757. This theory was further developed and defined as the modulus of elasticity by English scientist Thomas Young in 1807. Yet, building science wouldn't truly emerge until the end of the 19th century, as mass adoption of plumbing, electrical, and mechanical systems was underway. This was the second industrial revolution, which made way for more advancement as inventors improved the use of electric power and the manufacturing process. Brick and timber production was industrialized, America began to mass produce steel, concrete re-emerged with its new composite relationship with steel, and mechanical conditioning improved comfort for occupants. These construction technologies ushered in various project types, large bridges, railroads, and skyscrapers, and the Great Skyscraper Race rose to position the construction industry at the forefront of the economy. This attention and growing demand required and attracted a large workforce, and the need was satisfied from all over the world. Look for episode 2 of this series to hear more about the evolution of construction. So I know you do actual consulting where you're hired to go and basically teach a course, but I think it might have been your first form of teaching was the Building Science Fight Club, right? Where you're kind of breaking it down.
I would occasionally get paid to teach in person. Okay. So somebody right now, among architects, the education, the way we get continuing education is largely through materials manufacturers. They essentially subsidize a lot of continuing education. So they have an interest in providing, in getting in front of the audience that they want to sell to.
They do things
like hire people like me to teach on topics that are of interest or that they believe are of interest to architects. And so I did that a little bit, but it was really hard to do that for a few reasons. One is that I was a full-time consultant and, you know, I was working full time. So I'd have to get paid as much to teach as I would to consult to really make it worth my time.
Yeah.
So it was hard to really get into that. But it'd be hard to command to actually ask people for as much money as I was getting for consulting as I was for teaching, because I wasn't like, I didn't know how to teach like any others, right? Like, you know, I don't have practice in front of a crowd. I get nervous like anybody else.
Oh, man, leap before you look. It's all good. Just go for it, right?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm going to ask for money to do this, I ought to maybe kind of practice.
Yeah, what's your credential?
It's right? All about practice? Come on.
But, I mean, there's a skill in teaching, too. We've all had the experience in school of having really phenomenally wonderful, wonderful professors who are good at their subject matter, but who do not know how to communicate that to people who aren't at or near their own level. So anyway, I think I'm a pretty good teacher anyway, but I was on Instagram when I started. It was really to teach friends. It was sort of the added benefit of I get to kind of test drive material or practice a little bit, and I'd rather get a question from a few people online when I'm in my pajamas still sitting in the kitchen than in front of 200 people and where I've been paid to be there. And I'm like, I don't know what the answer to that is.
Yeah.
Of course, now it's the opposite. I'd rather get a question from only 200 people than if I put something online now, it's the stakes are a little bit higher. So I definitely read and reread and reread what I'm putting out there and make sure I get it technically accurate at least.
I just wanted to further explain what Christine is doing with the Building Science Fight Club. So if you do go to her Instagram, she breaks down details and she sketches out details, construction details of how things go together. And she does comparisons of why to do this or not do that and kind of goes through all these different conditions. So check her out, Building Science Fight Club.
So who is your audience when you're teaching?
So on Instagram, it's completely non-commercial. So there's no money for this. What I think of a classmate of mine in particular, I'll give her a little shout out. Her name is Jamie. She's awesome. And she and her wife are both architects. They were classmates of mine at Boston Architectural College. And they would always ask me questions about building science. And both of them are really smart and they're good at what they do. Until recently, they've started their own firm, but until recently, they worked at pretty fancy firms in Boston, and they still had these pretty technical questions, but somewhat, in some ways, kind of basic questions about construction and building science. And they're asking these questions really made me think, well, wow, if people as bright as the two of them and as successful in the traditional architectural career path can still have these questions, there must be a really big need for acquiring this type of knowledge about actual construction and how do you learn about building materials and how they perform in service. And architects don't have a great way of acquiring that skill set in a traditional, especially bigger firms, which are increasingly specialized. So I view, you know, Jamie in particular and Ashley as my audience. So smart people, good at what they do, but who haven't had the opportunity to spend as much time on a job site and don't like getting, especially later in their career, don't enjoy the experience of being caught flat footed on a job site and getting a question that from a contractor. Contractors can be pretty aggressive sometimes too. And
different mentality.
There's knowing when to push back and when to listen. And so that's who I think of as my audience.
And there's a bit of a stigma, I think, that you're also sort of breaking down, is that architects, while we go through training that touches a lot of things, it's hard to know all the intimate details of every little thing and how every single material comes together, because we're still going over theory and programs and 3D and all these other things. So there's this stigma and this embarrassment, I think, that architects have in this difficult time saying, I'm not quite sure how that goes together, and then trying to figure out how to put it together without being able to get to the field all the time, because you don't get to the field until you're sort of at that senior level.
I've never understood this, right? So help explain to me where the lines between being a designer, which is an architect, right? Mm-hmm. And an engineer start, stop, cross, whatever. Because the way as I understand it from a construction, from more of a field mentality, right? From what I see out in the field, is you have somebody that designs the home and puts it together, and I'm not taking a shot, does it in theory. Mm-hmm. And then the field and the engineers, if you will, come and say you can or can't do that. And then the field gets out there and is like, this isn't going to work. So are we saying it? So that's my mentality. So I would never look at an architect and be like, well, you should have known this. Mm-hmm. Is there a feeling like the architect should know that? Or is that the architect in place, like imposing that on themselves?
I think a little bit of both. And Christine, you can probably answer that too. I think there's a little bit of both, in my opinion. Maybe more so on the architect's side of I should know all of this because I'm an architect. Right. And I think you think back to the day when the architect was the master builder, in air quotes.
Okay.
And they were the one that controlled everything. And you feel like that's what you're supposed to be now.
Got it.
But I think there's a difference between then and now as the amount of stuff that we have to do and the responsibilities.
If you look at, like, I think several episodes ago, maybe it was last season or whatever, I was using the example of what a Finnish carpenter used to be before. Like, a Finnish carpenter used to be able to build anything. They could frame a house. They could put a foundation in. They could do the pretty stuff or whatever. Now it's like the guy installs base and case. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to oversimplify what they're doing, but it's like, the way that I feel is the architect comes up with the plan. Right, you have to have a general understanding of how it all works. I get that. But then ultimately, I think it slides over to somebody else who now specializes in that type of thing. So like when you're on a frame walk and we walk into a building and they don't like how something looks, it's like, I don't like this. And then it turns to the engineer and says, okay, now can I move this wall? Can I not? Not asking you if you can move that wall or not. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I would tend to think a lot of that could be displaced from there so you guys wouldn't have to feel that guilt of it.
Yeah. And I think architects also want it.
Okay.
So
that's another part of it.
There's a lot of internal pressure.
Okay, got it.
Christine, what do you?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to draw these lines, and I don't think that there's ever going to be a hard and fast place to draw them. And especially as every profession, but particularly this one, becomes more and more specialized, because what our buildings do for us now is really different from what they used to do for us when we were still in the era of master builders. We perform open heart surgery in some types of spaces. You had a podcast recently on mental health facilities. Like we customize and our buildings in ways that we never used to do before. So it's you're going to have this kind of specialization, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's good that we can so specifically tailor so many of our designs to specific uses and needs. But that being said, I think it really, really helps architects do the job of designing a lot better when they have an understanding of how things get built, and especially of how these buildings need to be cared for and maintained. So they're the ones advising the owner on stuff like durability and even cost, and saying, okay, so what kind of performance can you expect from this type of construction? Like, what do I pick as my sheathing material? What do I pick as my insulation? Where do I locate my insulation in the wall? Well, how does that influence energy efficiency? How does that influence water management and risk of failure? And you're advising people on, sometimes in the case of residential stuff, on often their single most expensive or valuable asset, the thing that houses the people that they love the most in the world. And understanding the literal nuts and bolts of this stuff can help you advise an owner a lot better, and helping them make these types of decisions. Like, is this an investment property for you? Or is this the house that you are retiring in? You approach that really differently from even from like a water management perspective. If something is professionally managed, you can make really different decisions than if something is managed by just a homeowner. Like, mm-hmm. It's, for instance, coatings that need to be maintained, like deck coatings or something. On an apartment building, to maintain a deck coating on a concrete balcony or a bunch of concrete balconies isn't really that big a deal, right? You've got a professional, the building's always going to be professionally managed.
Right. Hopefully.
But, exactly. But maintaining, suppose you've got a house, especially sort of a mid-range house, and you've got a waterproofing coating on a balcony that needs to be maintained. Now that's a real issue. In 10 years, is the homeowner even going to be the same homeowner? And are they going to remember that they have to recoat their balcony? In that sense, failure isn't always obvious, right? You see small cracks in a coating.
Yeah.
You don't know that you're rotting framing underneath, right, or what have you. There's a lot of different different decisions like that architects can be much better positioned to help owners make better decisions if they understand the process at play, and if they understand how hard it is. You know, the description earlier of, can I move this wall or can I not move this wall? Having a basic understanding of what you're asking for. That used to really bug me when I was early in my career, when I would have to ask for certain things. It used to bug me that I didn't know am I asking for something really, really hard, or am I asking for something really easy?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Is this going to take somebody? I remember the first like real experience I had, I was on a job site in the Bronx and I got mugged on the way to this job site.
Oh my God.
It was this weird New York story. I was on the subway and I was like, stop that man. And these two dudes ran him down and they got him. Anyway, so I had to file a police report. They caught him and I got my stuff back. But anyway, so I filed a police report and then I went to the job site and my job.
Badass, dude.
I was crazy.
There's the Fight Club part of building sciences, yeah. Right there.
Right? So I'm there and I've got this 3-foot level that I've carried from our office in the East Village on the subway. And I was supposed to, my task as an intern, my task was to measure the pitch of the pipes that were in the slab. Got and it. There were a bunch of concrete trucks that were showing up at 6 a.m. the next morning. This was for a big multifamily project. And I had no idea, first of all, that it is not typical for architects to go on job sites and measure stuff like whether there was appropriate pitch in the pipes. But I didn't know. I was just doing what I was told. And the pipes were flat. And so I say to the plumber, the pipes are flat, which also another breach in etiquette. Like the plumber does not work for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the pipes are flat. And the plumber's like, I've been doing this for 35 years. And no architect has ever come. Of course, I'm not an architect. I'm still a student even. No architect has ever come to a job site and told me what to do, how to do my job. And I didn't know what to do. But because I had been mugged, one of the principals at my office was worried about me and came. And he was a great guy. He's a mechanical systems designer and boiler mechanic. Fantastic New Yorker. A man of few words. Very intimidating. He comes up and talks to the plumber and says, you know, what's the problem? And the plumber repeats the problem. Like, you just don't understand how job sites in New York City are super tight. And this is just unrealistic. And, you know, the typical criticism that gets lobbied at architects all the time, right?
Yeah. It's,
You don't know how things work in the real world.
Right.
You can sit in your office and draw pretty pictures, right. But you don't know.
Right.
You know. And I'm listening to this and he sounds kind of reasonable, right? Well, he has been doing this for 30 years and things are different in the field. And
maybe that is how it is.
Right? I mean, yeah. Maybe. And the principal, Henry Gifford, he says, he doesn't say anything. So there's like uncomfortable, painful silence. And he says, well, you know, what does it say on the drawings? How much are the pipes supposed to slope to drain? 1/4 inch, a foot.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Second question, yes. Yeah, says, how much do they slope now? Well, they're flat. And then there's just, and he says, nothing. And I say, nothing. And the plumber says, nothing. And we're just sitting there for a little, we're standing on the rebar. I always find that fun to walk on rebar when it's still the cage. Anyway. So he says nothing. He turns around. It takes him, I don't know, another hour or two. He adjusts the pipes. They slope to drain and we're done. But based on how much he fought it before, I thought, yeah, I was asking him to like
move heaven and earth.
His right arm. Like, anyway, I've learned a lot since then, but I hated being in the situation where I didn't understand. I didn't have a sense of whether what I was asking was reasonable, unreasonable, what part of it might be reasonable, what part of it might not be, you know, so it was a little bit, it would have been nice for me to know that it was a bit of a breach in etiquette, certainly for an intern to show up and start talking to a subcontractor on a job site. I would have preferred to have known that walking in, yeah, but I also would have preferred to have known that I was not asking him to do anything very complicated. Yeah. And the entire thing was going to be encased in concrete the next morning. And if you're going to solve this problem, yeah,
now's
solve
the time to do it. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's
anyway,
funny.
So that's the type of stuff I try to help people with, help architects and people and designers with, is understanding when they really ought to back off and listen, and when it's, no, you got to check this now. It's never going to be easier than it is now to fix this issue. So let's have the conversation now.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Christine, so are you seeing sort of this change in perception about construction and appreciation for the technical and solution-based arena of building science?
Yes and no. In that, yes, but in a way that's actually, I think, not helpful. Okay. I think science in general it has a great reputation as a brand, you know, yeah, science.
Yeah.
You know, it's infallible. It's And it's neutral, right? It's totally value neutral. It's just science is science.
Yeah.
And in a way, I like that people are more interested in the mechanics of how these things work, but understanding building science isn't meant to be this cudgel to make people submit to your will. It's a tool, and it's a tool like any other tool. And it's this particular tool helps us understand how to balance performance and risk and durability, and how to integrate those concepts into a design. Going back to like Vitruvius, firmness, commodity, delight. And sometimes those things, those values are in harmony with each other. Sometimes something very durable is also very beautiful. Like a lot of our water management details on old school buildings they're beautiful, but they also serve as drips and kerfs and protect vulnerable spots like windows or whatever's underneath an overhang. So they're beautiful and they also increase durability. But sometimes these things are in opposition with each other as well, where something that makes, you know, you might not, overhangs are a great example. They greatly increase durability and the longevity of a particular facade, say, or they can increase the life of your cladding, your window, your whatever is being covered by it. But it's not always what we want to achieve in certain places. So yeah. Building science can't make that decision for you. It can't say, when do I borrow from one of these values to build up another? And when do I not do that? It can't tell you that. It can just help you understand the trade-offs so that you are happier with the end result, hopefully happier with the end result. But yeah, people really, especially now, there's people love science. Yeah. They're like, oh, that's so impressive. But when I talk about risk, they're a little less excited about that because nobody likes talking about risk. It's, I think people, in fact, a lot, people get very angry a lot of times when you talk to them about risk in buildings because they view this as just your responsibility. What do you mean there's a chance my windows can leak?
Yeah.
No, the percentage of acceptable failure is zero. There's not, you know, there should be no risk of failure. And I think what they do, I mean, this is more of psychology, but I think people repackage for themselves uncertainty as anxiety and anxiety as anger. You know, like my husband, we were talking about this the other day about being at the airport where you repackage anxiety and uncertainty as anger. Exactly. Where it's, you hear this flight is delayed and we have no idea when it's going to take off. Yeah. Well, it's really angry, but it's a totally different story of, well, we're swapping out planes. The new one will be here an hour and you'll still make your meeting. Done. Okay. I'll go have lunch. But anyway, people hate this, especially like in the single family home owners, especially hate this discussion of risk.
Yeah.
People who are on the development side are much more familiar with this and they understand managing risk and want to be able to do that more intelligently and efficiently and often, you know, save some money there. But homeowners, they don't like to think of this. They like to think more of their, you know, marble countertops.
Yeah.
What marbling pattern do they favor most?
Yeah.
Are you working with mostly like larger companies that are managing giant projects, or are you working more with principals who have kind of smaller scale projects, or maybe they're custom single family homes or things of that nature?
I do both. I started mostly in the larger projects. That was most of the business. And I loved that. Especially if your clients are, you know, you can have good, everybody has good clients and ones that are not as fun to work with. But if you've got good clients that can have those discussions and that know they're good at what they do. So developers that are really good at managing their own stuff, they're organized, makes it really fun to do my job where I can give them a concept, like say, okay, you guys are installing 20,000 windows a year. Let's look at what it would take to improve the installation to reduce your risk. And they can sit down because they know their business super well. And they can say, oh yeah, we can totally do this, this, and this, but this other thing, that's not going to work. Not all companies, even big ones that you think are really sophisticated, a lot of times they don't really know what they're doing in the field.
No idea. Yeah, generally no idea. Yeah.
And anyway, so I started with that. And then I would get occasionally really odd stuff from there. So they'd be residential projects, single family, but single family with really weird needs. Like I have bought a museum and I want to live in the museum, but the museum is a historic building. What? And I have $100 million art collection and I need to create gallery conditions in my personal residence. And I want bulletproof glass on historic
windows. This is a real example?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an amalgamation of several examples.
But I don't know the value of these people's art collection. I don't know. But yeah, this is actually a real example. How do we put bulletproof glass on historic windows? You're not going to replace the glass on the windows. So you want storm shutters, for example. So you have bulletproof storm windows on the interior. Now, if you do that and you're in a cold climate, that changes how your yeah. wall performs, and you yeah. have an issue. You may have an issue with condensation.
Yeah.
So first of all, how do you know if you're going to have an issue with condensation, and how do you fix that? Yeah. And how do you go about addressing that? So anyway, weird stuff. Like, I mean, I guess it makes sense when you lay it out, but it's certainly unusual stuff like that. And that stuff is really fun. So when it's been single family homeowners, it's been so stuff that's kind of unusual like that. And it's been more, but usually it's big scaled stuff. So any residential work on homes will be more production type. So people who are repeating the same thing over and over. So there's a real economy. If they can address risk, it's broad, right? They're repeating something a lot of times. So it really does make a difference. The value equation is a little different on individual homes. And a lot of times it's as for me as a professional, it's a little harder for me to do that work and still be worth it for a client, right? I'm expensive. Yeah. So what, maybe they don't need the kind of handholding that I'm going to provide if they're only doing it this one time. So anyway, so to answer your question, it's a little bit of both, but it tends to be stuff that's bigger and more repeated. I get in my personal life and certainly on Instagram, I'll get like, hey, I'm renovating my attic. What kind of insulation should I use? And I try to answer that sometimes to help people, but it's usually there are too many variables and yeah. I have to do just as much work as I would for the guy who wants bulletproof glass, or I have to do 75% of the amount of work to understand their job, but I don't get paid. So there's less time to help people.
Yeah. I'm going through Reno right now. Can we talk about bulletproof glass? No,
absolutely.
Christine, so when you're working with your clients, what tends to be sort of the more complex part of the process that you're trying to solve?
I think I'm not sure if this is going to answer your question the way you intend to ask it, but the thing that helps me the most, or that helps other people the most, architects the most in teaching about this stuff, that helps them solve most amount of problems, is understanding the division of labor among the trades. That is the single biggest help. When architects can start to understand who's responsible for what piece, what element that they draw in any given detail, it helps them draw much better details. So for example, understanding, okay, so I've got this window and I need to draw a window detail. What are the trades involved in this? And what are the order that they're going to show up on the job site? Uh-huh. So first the framer is going to be there. And so then I've got a framer, then, and this changes depending on the region you're in. Mm-hmm. Then I've got a waterproofing subcontractor, uh-huh. and the waterproofing subcontractor will prepare the rough opening. And sometimes that waterproofing subcontractor is also the glazing contractor and will also install the window. In some places, they'll have a sheet metal contractor, and that person is responsible for the sheet metal on the whole job, whether it's on the roof, whether it's, you know, at a door detail, whether it's wherever it is. And understanding who's responsible for what, and understanding that the project gets bought out differently. So the contractor takes the drawings and subs it out to, you know, their subcontractors, bids it out to. So, and those subcontractors will bid on individual pieces of it. And one of the big misses that we have is when subcontractors when we miss something, something is unclear in whose scope it falls under. So in a detail, you've got a clad enclosure piece or something, and we're not really sure, well, is that in the cladding installer's scope, or is that in the glazing contractor's scope? Is that in, whose scope does it fall under?
Which, by the way, then they're not going to ask the question, so they can charge more when it gets down the line in construction.
Yeah. Exactly. And so something that is really clear and easy, like sealant joints around windows are such a, such an easy example of this. Sometimes it's unclear to the contractor. You can argue about whose fault this is, because people do argue about whose fault it is every time. But, in the, this, a sealant joint, is that a sealant joint that is bought and owned in the scope of the painter or the drywall installer? Or is that a functional sealant joint that's meant to be part of how the window system operates and it gets installed by the glazer? And now if you forget that and you have the argument afterwards, that sealant joint goes from being basically no cost, you know, included in the scope, to a really expensive sealant joint. So understanding the division of labor among the trades and drawing your details in a way that makes it as easy as possible, and it for a contractor to clear, have a clear sense of who's responsible for what, ends up being like, it takes people's practices from, maybe not their practice, but it takes their experience during construction administration from being nightmarish to much easier.
Yeah. Well, not only the cost thing too, when you use that sealant joint as a example, you probably would want the waterproofer doing it, because he's going to look at it differently in how he packs that joint and make sure no water is going to get in, as opposed to a painter who's going to come in and just make sure it's sealed from the outside so he can get a nice clean line. You know what I mean? Exactly. It's two very different principles and theories of thought that go around it. With the cost factor as well, when you do it after and it's not part of a proposal. So,
and a lot of times architects don't know, in that they're using something, they've got so many things to pay attention to, and so they're just cutting and pasting. So this is the window detail we did on the last job.
Yep.
And they're not really paying attention to what they've drawn, and they're not entirely they haven't thought that through. Whose scope is this under? When do I expect to see this? When I do my site visits, when should I see this? When should I not see it? And if the contractor is proposing doing something different, is that acceptable to me? Does that change performance a little bit? Does it? What should my condition be if I'm going to agree to this, or is it okay?
Do you think there's been a change in the industry that's created that culture, or is it something that's just always existed, of this lack of understanding, maybe in some cases, of what those different responsibilities are and how you change a detail based on that?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say, because I'm sort of like, does a fish know it's wet? I'm in the business, so it's hard for me to say, but I certainly think it's very natural. This is not how we're really taught in schools. We're actually working sort of the opposite way. I had to learn a totally different way of understanding buildings after school. So in school, you're trying to achieve a desired aesthetic, and then you're kind of working backwards. When I draw a detail, I draw it the way it's built. So I draw like what's going to go in first, what's going to go in second. So even my drawings are sort of, they're a virtual mock-up. I'm building it in my mind as I draw something. And those are, it's really hard when you're in the habit of one to switch to the other. And architects have to be in the habit of, well, what is the desired effect? You don't want them doing it the way I'm or doing it only the way I'm recommending. So it's really, it's a hard skill set to be able to do both of those things at once, but nobody said our jobs were going to be easy, I guess.
In general, have you seen the industry sort of evolve over your time of since you've exited school and where you're at now?
I think so. It's when I was in school, people were really, really interested in green. Mm-hmm. And the USGBC was pretty much brand new, and we were really excited about LEED and that kind of stuff. In my professional, now, so it's hard to know if I can attribute this to just an industry change or the change from being a student to the realities of professional practice. Yeah. So I got my start working on extraordinarily energy efficient buildings. In order to design really, really energy efficient buildings, you need to know a lot about heat transfer, thermodynamics, air barriers, all the technical, you need to know a lot about construction. It matters how the buildings get built, not just how they're drawn. And as I got further and deeper into practice, most of my clients are interested not in stuff like energy efficiency. They're interested in risk. Hmm. And I, some of that's natural sort of real world stuff, right? What do I contend with? Well, I don't want to get sued. Yeah. How do I make this not suck?
Yeah.
As opposed to how do I make this awesome? The first step is let's stop the bleeding here.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
So I don't know. So there's, I suppose there's been a little bit of a change that way. Maybe we're getting newly interested in energy efficiency, and certainly, and there's a huge interest in carbon in particular. People don't like, they talk, actually that's a difference. We talked about energy efficiency 20 years ago. Now we're talking about carbon. Just sort of, I'll stay neutral on whether I think that's helpful or not, but.
Please don't. No,
change. Certainly a change.
Yeah. Now, looking ahead, are you starting to see trends or anything in society that's making construction sort of change and what you're telling your clients or what questions they're asking?
Yeah, I think we're seeing, I think people are starting to see things unravel a lot in ways that's very upsetting to them. So for example, we're coming across a big crisis related to stucco that's just starting. And this is I don't think you're seeing this as much in California because you have such a wonderful, awesome climate out there where this type of failure happens a lot less, but we're insulating our buildings a lot more right now. And we're having to contend with when you do that, less energy passes across the enclosure, across the wall assembly, for example, the roof assembly. And when you have less energy crossing it, which is a good thing, right? That's the whole point. We want less energy, right? But it means that we're reducing drying substantially. And so when we reduce drying, it means that the stuff that we used to be able to get away with, like bad flashing details, bad water management, we can't get away with that stuff anymore. And it was never a good idea to have stuff that leaked or that wasn't flashed properly. But now we're seeing real failures. And we see this particularly with stucco because it's most of the world, we put stucco on directly on block walls, right? Like that's mm-hmm. what you see in all of Europe. Got masonry construction and stucco goes over top of it as a render. And in North America, we build really lightweight framed buildings and often out of moisture sensitive materials. And this is a great thing in a lot of ways in that it is much, much cheaper and faster to build things here. And so a lot more, you know, housing is less expensive. There's, you know, office space is less expensive. There's all kinds of advantages to this lightweight, cheaper construction.
And by lightweight, you're talking stick framing and that type of stuff, right?
Exactly. Okay. Anything framed is literally less heavy. And we often do this out of materials that are moisture sensitive, particularly wood stuff.
Right, right.
So we're using a sheathing now. We're using, instead of plywood, we're using OSB, oriented strand board.
Right.
And OSB's tolerance for moisture is a lot less than some of these old materials, even dimensional lumber, like from 100-year-old trees, that wood that's in my crawl space right now could get pretty wet before it started to rot.
Right.
You build the same thing out of new growth wood, and suddenly the building on the same soil, in the same climate, now you insulate it. Well, now things start to actually rot.
Right.
And we have to make changes accordingly. But to return to stucco, we've got stucco on framed buildings with two layers of building paper.
Right.
And it used to be the building paper we used to use was this thick, heavy asphalt impregnated paper, felt paper.
Like 60 minute stuff type of deal, right?
Exactly. And we call it 30-pound felt or 15-pound felt. And it used to actually weigh 30 pounds per 100 square feet.
Right.
Well, now we use number 30 felt. It's not 30 pounds. It's more dimensionally stable. So it's a better product, but it doesn't have the same kind of rag content that it used to. And so back in the day when we put stucco on this, the felt paper would expand because the stucco is wet, right?
Right.
And as it cured, it would debond from the back of the stucco as it dried out. So you'd have this little bitty space between stucco and the old school asphalt impregnated building papers. And that was for drainage. And what we're finding now, in about 2000, we changed the codes to respond to this because we knew, okay, these papers aren't they're not debonding anymore.
Right.
So we require, the building code requires two layers of felt, both, right. you know, felt paper,
right.
Type B coated paper. So,
which is generally that two layers of 60 minute paper you see, right?
Exactly. That's what the two, so the first layer is for water management. The second layer, that the one that sticks to the stucco, is a bond break, and all it's a spacer. It's there to create that, to recreate that little space. But what we're finding now is that when we use, and that was fine with plywood and poorly insulated walls. But now when we have better insulation, more insulation, and OSB instead of plywoods, these buildings are completely destroyed. They're rotting. You have to reclad, resheathe, mitigate mold, and replace, sometimes replace some certain framing elements. And people are losing that after 5 years, after 8 years, 10 years, and people are losing all of the equity in their house.
Wow.
And it's becoming a big issue. And I think that sort of my fear in this is that it's sort of similar to the energy efficiency stuff, is that people look at this and they say, well, there's the problem with using insulation. That's the problem with using stucco, or that's the problem with airtight homes. Wag their fingers at the whole, back in the day, we used to be so much better.
But it's just a system problem overall, because you're looking at one component versus another.
Exactly. And the issue isn't with stucco. The issue isn't with insulation. The issue is with water management.
Right.
And so we have to get better at water management when we make these other improvements. So just saying like, well, we have these problems and they're expensive, so therefore we should have leaky buildings.
We should go backwards.
Yeah. And that's some of my fear with this, is that when, in response to really big failures, and these are big failures, I think there's a lawsuit. I'm not sure if it's been settled yet, but it's like $100 million lawsuit against Toll Brothers in Pennsylvania right now. There's a lot going on in Florida. Like this is just the tip of the iceberg for us here, unfortunately. And my fear is that we'll respond to it the wrong way instead of the right way.
When you're saying there's an issue with stucco, then are you saying that what you guys are going to more so in those areas that you're referring to, not so much California because it's pretty stable climate, but you've got like your sidings and those types of things because it more so sheets the water as opposed to absorbs it? What is the solution to that? I mean, in general, so somebody can get a quick hit idea, you know?
So the idea is basically what we do is there's a few different ways that walls can manage water. And in the United States, the most common wall water management strategy is drainage. Mm-hmm. So the drainage and WRB, or water resistive barrier approach.
It's like a Tyvek?
And, pardon me?
Like a Tyvek wrap? Like, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, Tyvek building paper. And you can use anything you want. Is zip system, you can, a fluid applied. But the concept is, I guess I'll do it and I'll contrast it with the other water management strategy, which is storage, redistribution, and controlled release. And that's like, picture a castle or a mass wall. You've got a big mass there. And the way we manage water is, well, we allow whatever it is to get wet and slowly dry in both directions.
Right.
And it's not made out of anything moisture sensitive, so it can do that and there's no problem.
Right.
With framed walls, the best approach tends to be this, well, we have some sort of primary water control layer, and then we have a cladding that sheds water but doesn't really block it.
Okay.
And in order for that primary water control layer to do its job properly, we have to give it literally give it room to work.
To breathe.
So you want a space between the cladding and the water control layer. We call that draining and back venting your cladding.
Okay.
And it's a great idea no matter where you are, even in California, but it's extremely important in any climate that gets more than 20 inches of rain a year. We're finding that tends to be the dividing line where, okay, if you get more than 20 inches of rain a year, you really need to make sure that that space is open and clear and can drain. In California, the two layers of building paper appears to be pretty sufficient for most types of buildings.
So I had a question. I'm glad you brought it back up. I've seen some builders try to get rid of that second layer. What does that do
Is it the second layer, or is it going to the idea of the, like, because my question's around the one coat stucco where they're using the foam now those types of things.
So I've seen builders say we don't need two layers of
paper.
Yeah.
Okay.
What does that do or not do? What are your thoughts on that?
It depends on why they're doing that. If they're just saying we don't need two layers, that's contrary to the code. And what they're doing is assuming that the layer that they've got, the one that's still there, will stick to the stucco. They've got a real problem. And most of the times it does. Now, they argue correctly by code anyway. The code does allow you to eliminate one of those layers if you're using a fluid applied membrane or an integral sheathing plus water and air control layer. Now this, I don't know if you see this very much in California, but there's a product called Zip. It's made by Huber, but there are a few other similar products where the sheathing itself has a coating on it and it becomes the water control layer, and you tape the seams of the sheathing. So your framer who's installing the sheathing ends up being responsible for the water control for the whole building.
Oh, wow.
Which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, in that case, the code only requires you to use one layer behind your stucco. That's what's required by code. But I think that on really anything, like, can you get away with only using two layers? Sure. And in California, if you're doing a bungalow maybe with generous overhangs and it's dry, you're San Diego, sure, knock yourself out. But if you're doing anything more substantial, a taller building that gets more abused by wind and rain and stuff, you'll want a bigger space. And you can use a textured building wrap, also harder to obtain in California because you guys are so used to using the type D coated felts.
Yeah.
But they make those that are kind of crinkled.
Yeah.
And that provides a little bit of a space for drainage. If you're using a panel product like that Jason talked about, you can do that as well, but you still need drainage behind that panel. And this is true for any cladding, right? A panelized fiber cement cladding.
Yeah.
You want to install that over furring or some sort of offset to allow drainage and drying behind it to keep it as. And actually that, of all of the things I teach about, the single easiest way to make your building more forgiving of construction defects or bad details is to provide a generous space behind your cladding for drainage and drying.
Just air gaps, basically.
If you don't, you're just less likely to ever have a problem if you have drainage and drying. You raise the stakes a lot when you increase exposure, and that's what you're doing when you don't let stuff drain away. It means that your tools for, I guess, to have a leak, you have to have. It helps to think of it in this way. To have a leak, you have to have a source of water.
Right.
You have to have a pathway for the water to get from where it is to where you don't want it to be. And you have to have some sort of driving force to push it along that pathway. And then you have to have something that gets damaged. Now, when we detail buildings, we tend to focus on the pathways, right? Let's seal up all the pathways, make sure that we don't have any pathways. But we forget that you can address any one of those four things to reduce your risk. And it's often a lot more effective to reduce the driving force, which is, in this case, it's hydrostatic pressure and wind-driven rain, capillary. If you provide this space, there's no force that directs water into those pathways. Gravity takes over, takes it down the building, and you're fine. So address the... That's often a lot more practical than trying to seal all of the penetrations, because there are tons of penetrations that we can't seal.
Well, so, it's interesting even that you talk about like hydrostatic pressure, because even on the interior of homes, right, when you're comprising showers and those types of things, you're trying to explain to people, you know what I mean, how hydrostatic pressure works, because essentially they put in some type of membrane or whatever to the studs and they slam all that mud right against it. And it's like, look, you're creating a fermenting area that's never going to dry, A, because the mud's sucking it all up, and B, there's nowhere for the moisture to go. Except for in some tar-laden mud, you know, mud-packed pan, which
and
is
this is how you will get your way with clients. You use the word fermenting.
Oh, I do it all the time. I do.
Nobody wants that. They'll
I do
like,
it all the time. I'm like, it's just. I'm like, all the stuff you're washing out and everything else is just fermenting in here, and they just kind of freak out. I'm like, exactly. Like you got it.
There you go.
That's
you
interesting. Fear. Because it's on the inside. It's on the inside as well. Like, you know, we talk about the issues that you have on the outside, but how many leaks do you get on the inside of a house from an old shower pan and those types of things?
Yeah.
Because the stuff's just been sitting in there and never dries.
That's so never gross. Dries. Yeah. So gross.
It's the truth, though. It's the truth. She's all excited about a horrible work. It's the truth. You know what I mean?
Somebody, there's an architect, I think he's in California, Studio Goldfinch, he posted something on Instagram. He showed a clear car, and which is cool, right? Because you can see how the car work is clear. Anyway, and he was saying, what if we did the same thing with buildings? And
nope.
It would be cool, but it would be so gross.
So scary.
I mean, you spend any amount of time actually on construction sites and you realize even stuff that ends up looking beautiful. It's like, gosh, yeah. I remember when I started, I asked my first boss, I was like, is it always so gross? He's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it really is.
They're always like this.
It's bad, man. It's bad.
We'll have to have you back, Christine, to talk forensics and get deep into that world. But we're up against it for today. But it was so much fun having you on. Really appreciate you joining us.
Super interesting. Like, super interesting.
Well, I just love y'all's podcast. It's so interesting for me to learn about. Our industry is so broad, and it's so neat to learn about different areas of specialty. It's just so cool. I was telling you, Dimitri, that I loved your interview with your former boss.
Yeah. Yeah, David Olson.
David Olson. Yeah. Fantastic. Great stories. And anyway, it's just neat stuff that you don't, that I don't think about too, because I stop once you get to the, anything that's not wet. I'll deal sometimes with wet rooms, but I stop and there's so much more cool stuff going on. And I just love listening. So keep it up, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you for joining us, Christine. Make sure to follow her Building Science Fight Club on Instagram.
And are you allowed to talk about Fight Club?
Yes. I'm sure she's heard that before once or twice.
That's all for this episode, but keep listening for a sneak peek of our next episode. This show is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. You can help support what we're doing here by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on your preferred podcasting app. It helps others find us, and your support is the only way that this show grows. And don't forget to connect with us through our Facebook community, Instagram, and see the random thoughts and articles that we share on Twitter and LinkedIn. But before you go, next time on Spaces Podcast.
The complexity is not actually building anymore. The complexity is trying to get it through building departments.
There's a miscellaneous steel model, and because one of the king studs wasn't labeled correctly, it got missed in the clash detection process. So they have these, huge pipes in this wall, and now we're having to re-engineer parts of the wall so that these massive pipes can get through.
But in terms of design and what we do in the field, especially on the plumbing side, there's a huge push towards a heavy amount of efficiency, specifically related to water reusage. Most of our designs now, especially in commercial buildings, and a lot of times now multifamily buildings, we're seeing a much larger use of rainwater and gray water collection and recycling that water for either irrigation usage or, if it's rainwater, possibly even back towards fixtures.
And thank you again for spending some time with us. Talk soon.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with detailed and original podcasts by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, we really were able to work with teams at Nike branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
another challenge of the shuttle is actually in putting it in launch position is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically, you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.